Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
He's been convicted of fraud, is facing new charges of illegal lobbying and influence peddling, was an advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and now he's written a book about his time in government. Bruce Carson joins us to talk about his legal troubles, the revelations in his book, and what he thinks will happen in the next election.
At a global summit in Toronto, the Prime Minister has made a major investment in his maternal and child health initiative, committing an additional $3.5 billion to the effort to save millions of lives. We take a look at the controversy around the exclusion of abortions, and we speak with NGOs at the summit about where we go from here.
This week, all parties voted in favor of a motion in the House of Commons aimed at setting up a national strategy on end-of-life care. We're joined by the author of the motion, NDP MP Charlie Angus.
We also discussed the challenges for the government as it prepares to announce what it will do to procure new fighter jets following the F-35 fiasco. And we take a look at new environmental laws that will soon be announced by U.S. President Barack Obama.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Monday, Bruce Carson, a one-time advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, begins his pre-trial on a charge of influence peddling. But before heading to the courts, Mr. Carson has released a book. It's called 14 Days and gives us a first-hand backroom look at the conservative movement from the fall of Kim Campbell in 1993 to Carson's departure from the Prime Minister's office in 2008.
Carson had previous convictions for fraud, and he was disbarred by the Law Society of Upper Canada. But when Harper and his Conservatives took power in 2006, Carson was hired as a senior advisor. Since leaving the PMO, Carson has faced allegations of influence peddling for his work trying to bring water filtration system to First Nations. And just weeks ago, he was charged with additional counts of influence peddling and illegal lobbying for his work with energy organizations.
To talk more about the book, I'm joined on the phone by Bruce Carson.
Oh, pleasure, Cormac.
Now, before we get to the revelations in the 306 pages of your book, I want to discuss the personal issues you're facing, and specifically these new charges and your upcoming pretrial.
Well, the purpose of the pretrial, as I understand it, is to determine whether the Crown has enough evidence for the case to be bound over for trial. So the Crown will be putting on its evidence, and we'll just see what the judge thinks. There's also another issue that has arisen dealing with the Lobbying Act and my attempts with a number of others to put together the very beginnings of a Canadian energy strategy. And the RCMP announced, I guess, a couple of weeks ago that they were laying charges, and at some point there'll be a court date set for those as well.
On that note, though, I mean, you've become a political attack tool for the opposition party, specifically the NDP. They're basically questioning the judgment of the Prime Minister, and they have been for a long time, for hiring you. How does it make you feel that, once being an advisor to the Prime Minister and helping him, but now you are the basis of an attack on the person you once advised?
It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. No one has ever questioned my ability to give advice and the advice that I've given. One would have hoped that especially the NDP would have some sympathy with somebody trying to dig themselves out of a hole and come back and do a decent job advising.
Now we'll turn our attention to the book where you look at 14 key events in the conservative movement starting back in 1993, but I'm going to jump to the 2006 election. You reveal the conservatives had a mole in the Liberal Party. Tell me about that, and who was this mole?
Well, it's unfortunate that the knowledge of that died with Doug Finlay, our really great, unbelievably good campaign manager. It's one of those things that just came out of the blue. Doug called me up and said, I've got this situation where we're going to get the Liberal platform before it's publicly released. I've got a guy in the Liberal war room. So Doug went ahead, and I came back from Montreal after the debates and got the platform in my hands and set to work a group that evening. And unfortunately, I guess for us, there wasn't much in the platform. I don't know who it was, and I don't know anything more about it than than when I wrote it in the book, than what I wrote in the book. But it was an interesting phenomenon at that time.
Now, you also reveal in this book that Prime Minister Stephen Harper nearly stepped down over the Chuck Cadman affair and claims that he knew about the offer of an insurance policy to Mr. Cadman. Why don't you take me inside the room when that conversation was happening, when the Prime Minister was considering what to do?
So we went down to a 24 Sussex, and Ian revealed what was going on, and this book had come out, and there was an allegation that a bribe had been offered to Chuck Cadman. When we walked in, the Prime Minister was quite concerned about this, and quite concerned that if there was going to be an RCMP investigation, he might have to step aside for the time of that investigation. And we quickly disabused him of that idea, that Cretchen and perhaps others had stayed on, and there was no reason at all to step aside because of an investigation that may or may not happen, and get over that, and let's just deal with the problem we have at hand.
Now, you not only look at previous issues within the conservative movement, but current issues within the conservative movement as well. You talk about the Senate scandal, and you say in your book that it's harmed Harper's credibility and his reputation for integrity as an effective manager of the country's business. Do you think that through the scandal, with what happened with Mike Duffy, and more specifically how that case was handled, and the check written by his chief of staff at the time, Nigel Wright, $90,000 check. Has the Prime Minister or his government turned their backs on the ethical standards that everyone had rode to power on back in 2006?
I don't think so. I think that what could have been done better was the management of that issue. I think that usually when you're try to manage an issue like this, and we had plenty when I was there, you try to get all the facts, as bad as they are, as smelly as they are, and put them out with your particular view of them. And it seemed that just wasn't done, or they couldn't do it.
You said that in the government that you were a part of, when you were an advisor, that in the Ian Brody PMO, the Harper would have known almost immediately about anything untoward, any bad actions or activities by a senator or things going on within his government. Is it plausible then to believe that the Prime Minister would not have known about a deal like this in his own office, a $90,000 check cut?
Yes, I think it is. It is quite plausible.
Is it plausible deniability? Just like,
no,
I don't want to know what happens?
No, I think it's just a different management style. Like, I don't cast any aspersions on the Prime Minister. I think he just didn't know. And if he says he didn't know, he didn't know. It's too much of a gamble to say I didn't know when he actually did know. It's just, you wouldn't do that, and he wouldn't do that.
Now, let's look at a different scandal that's happened with the Prime Minister more recently with the Supreme Court. He made an appointment of Justice Nadon, and Nadon was found by the Supreme Court to be ineligible. And since then, we've had this sort of war of words where the government seems to be implying that the Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, did something improper by giving them a shout to let them know that Mr. Nadon would not be eligible. First off, on this issue, would you have advised the Prime Minister to make the Nadon appointment?
The issue is, I think Cormac, is whether you take any chance at all. And if you're completely risk adverse, like I am, and maybe not in my personal life, unfortunately, but completely risk adverse, which I would be in which I think we were in government, is you don't go ahead.
So you would have advised against this?
If I had been there, I would have, yeah.
So the Supreme Court decided that Mark Nadon was ineligible, and for the time being, or for a moment of time, it seemed like that was it. It was done, it was dealt with, and everybody was moving on. And then we had this leak, so to say, of allegations that the Chief Justice had been lobbying against Marc Nadon. And since then, both the justice minister and prime minister have been implying that Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin did something inappropriate by calling to raise the issue of Nadon's ineligibility. So what do you make of that? Why do that?
Well, that makes no sense to me, quite frankly. I have yet to hear any plausible explanation for it. There may be some strategic reason down the road that one is not aware of, but at this point, it doesn't make any sense.
In your book, you look back at 14 days that made the conservative movement. So I want you to take a look at a 15th day in 2015 on Election Day. What do you think is going to happen?
You know, this isn't being partisan. I don't think that Mulcair has been able to convince Canadians that he's moved that party to the middle. And I think we all await Mr. Trudeau is going to do with regard to the economy. So I think that the 2015 election, when it comes to jobs and the economy, I think that's playing to the Prime Minister's strength. There's quite a good possibility the government will get reelected. Whether it gets reelected with a majority or minority, that's another question.
On the opposition front, do you see a shift?
I think that's in the cards. I think it's, you know, not that I'm any expert on NDP politics or Liberal politics, but I think it's going to be hard for Mr. Trudeau to leap from third to first. But I think there's certainly a leap that could be made to second. The issue around Mr. Mulcair is does he have the Jack Layton appeal that appealed to Quebec voters in 2011? I think that's doubtful. But God knows, I'm sure he'll try. I think that Trudeau has certainly the ability and the people around him to certainly move from third to second.
That was Bruce Carson, former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper and author of the book 14 Days, Making the Conservative Movement in Canada. To listen to the full interview, go to macleans.ca.
Coming up, we take a look at the Toronto Summit for the Prime Minister's Maternal Health Initiative, and we speak with an expert about whether the government will stick with the controversial F-35 or look elsewhere for a new fighter jet.
Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Macleans Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we look at a strategy for end-of-life care, what the government may do about the F-35 fiasco and the replacement for our aging CF-18s, and U.S. President Barack Obama prepares to unveil new environmental standards. But first,
Prime Minister Stephen Harper held a global summit in Toronto this week for his maternal, newborn, and child health care initiative. It began in 2010 during the G8 summit when he launched the Muskoka Initiative, aimed at saving the lives of millions of mothers and newborns in developing countries.
4 years after that announcement, this summit has taken place to take stock of how far we've come and where we go from here. Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced Canada would commit an additional $3.5 billion for vaccinations, nutritional programs, and boosting health care around the world. But there has been some controversy with the initiative, since Canada's commitment does not contain funding for abortions in countries where it is legal. 129 women die each day because they can't get safe abortions.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper addressed the issue head-on during the last day of the summit.
We all know very well how divisive that issue is, not just in Canada. I can assure you it's equally divisive around the world. We're acting on a vote in Parliament on this matter that was very clear. And frankly, you know, we've got to keep people focused on what we agree on, which is broadly saving the lives of mothers and their babies. And we're obviously not going to embark on something that's going to cause widespread division, because we have got the world community mobilized behind these objectives.
Meanwhile, Maclean's science reporter Kate Lunau attended the summit. To take a look at where we go from here, she speaks with Dr. Seth Berkley, the CEO of the Gavi Alliance, which works to bring immunization programs to the world's poorest countries.
Tell me a little bit about the work that Gavi has done growing out of the Muskoka Initiative. What's changed from then to today?
Well, Gavi has grown a lot in size and scope. So when Gavi was originally established, now 2000, so well before the Muskoka initiative, it really was about one vaccine. It was about hepatitis B, which is the first cancer vaccine, and getting that out. And today, every lower-income developing country, except for one, is using that vaccine as a result of Gavi. But since then, we've grown the number of vaccines, and there's been a rapid scale-up since 2010 when Muskoka was announced. And today we have 11 different vaccines that we're working with countries to roll out. And as I said, these are vaccines against multiple cancers and against the largest killers of children.
So what are the priorities today when we talk about vaccination? What parts of the world and what conditions are we vaccinating against?
So there are a number of infectious diseases that are important for children, and we've had classically vaccines. Six of them have been in the expanded program of immunization, which just celebrated its 40th anniversary last week. Those vaccines are against diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, measles, polio, and tuberculosis, BCG. Measles, obviously an important thing here in Canada still, and it just shows that these infectious diseases still are around and we have to worry about them. Polio, which, as you know, we're close to finishing eradication, but we're not there yet, and in fact, in this year, we've seen a lot of spread. So those are the six basic vaccines that are being rolled out. But today, we have vaccines against rotavirus, which is the largest cause of diarrhea, of pneumococcus, which is the largest cause of pneumonia, rubella, which is the cause of congenital rubella syndrome, which is congenital anomalies in kids. And so a lot of other vaccines that are out there that can make a difference. And the challenge is getting them out to people. And so Gavi does two things. One is to work with countries to get these vaccines out and to subsidize them for the very poor countries, because every country pays something for the vaccines. If you're very poor, you pay a little. As you get wealthier, you pay more. But the other thing is to help strengthen their health system so that they can deliver these vaccines and reach those that are unreached.
Can you tell me why it's important at a summit like this to address maternal and newborn health? There's been a lot made of the difference that something like this can have on entire countries' economies and so forth, development goals.
Well, first of all, Melinda Gates, who just gave a lovely talk at lunch, one of the things she made a point of is that, you know, we may divide these up into different specialties, but a mother thinks about, you know, finishing her pregnancy safely, delivering safely, then having a newborn that hopefully lives to a child and on to an adulthood, and there's no sharp points there. Now, what's happened in the field is that partially as a result of immunization, child deaths have come down dramatically. We've seen a 49% reduction since 1990, and that's been very dramatic. Mm-hmm. And still today, 6.6 million kids are dying a year, but that's down from 12.6. And, you know, we're going to keep trying to drive that down. The difference is for maternal deaths, we've seen a reduction not quite as steep, and neonatal deaths have been the hardest. In fact, they now represent 44% of the child deaths because the interventions have been harder to get out, and with us reducing deaths from vaccine-related diseases, you know, they have stayed and been stuck. And so Melinda focused on some of the interventions that could be done for those children, which are really powerful.
Now, next year, the Millennium Development Goals are set to expire. And what needs to happen next? I mean, coming out of a summit like this, what do you hope to see in terms of policy and progress?
Well, there's two things that are critical. One, from my perspective, one is that we're not going to be finished. So, for example, we won't hit the MDG4, the child mortality target. We'll come close. We won't hit it. Now, it would be a disaster if we all of a sudden said, oh, well, these aren't important anymore. Now let's go do something else. So the challenge will be to finish the important agenda that is there as part of the Millennium Development Goals. But, of course, there were other things that were not included. And for me, it's critical that in the next period we focus really on two things, and that is, you know, how do we have healthy people and a healthy planet? And the point is you can't focus on one or the other, because if you have an unhealthy planet, that will eventually affect the health of people. And the same thing goes. People are critical to the problems that have existed on the planet. So making sure both of those get priority in the next period is going to be critical.
It's interesting, I guess, sort of. So is the implication then that in the future, when we talk about maternal and newborn health care, we'll also be talking about things like sustainability, environmental issues, the spread will just continue?
Well, I mean, what's really interesting about this is that we're now talking about population numbers that are extraordinary. And, you know, in a sense, we're talking about 9.5 billion people on Earth. And, And that does challenge the carrying capacity of Earth. Obviously, science and technology can play a very important role, and it is doable. But the challenge is, how do those two things interplay? And it's important to pay attention to both of them.
Our science reporter, Kate Lunau, also talked to Rosemary McCarney, the CEO of Plan Canada. They discussed the government's $3.5 billion funding commitment and what major challenges lie ahead.
Coming out of the summit and coming leading up to the summit, I think what we've been very clear on is that we do need focus. You just have to keep a focus. You have to re-engage and renew, whether it's funding commitments or geographical focus, etc. But that this issue of vulnerable and most excluded, that's where we've got to put the focus. And that's going to be more challenging, more difficult, more expensive. We're going to have fewer quick successes. We're going to have some failures, and we're not going to get it right the first time. It's just going to be a more complex area. But this is the area where we've got to be, and I think with all of the expertise in this country, the network, the Canadian Network on Maternal Newborn Child Health, and these are the pros. They're on the front line. They're back in the universities and the hospitals, but this is their life passion, and they are renowned around the world as the global experts. We know what to do. It's going to be challenging, but we know what to do. We can do this. We can do this job, and I think that's why we're very, very pleased with this announcement that was made today, too, on day two of the summit, because the announcement said a number of things. I think the announcement said we're going to keep the focus. We're going to maintain the momentum. We're going to double down on the big areas that are killing, or that are killing from preventable causes, women and children, and particularly the newborn, where we're still losing over 1 million children every year in the first 24 hours of their life. I think one of the most poignant things I heard today was every child born is a promise. Every child who dies is a broken promise, a wasted life. And I think that, that's something that Canadians can feel very proud of, is that there's this army of Canadians out there supported by a priority initiative of this government of Canada, who are saving millions of lives. We're changing destinies every single day, and that feels pretty good.
That was Maclean Science reporter Kate Lunau speaking with the CEO of the Gavi Alliance and the CEO of Plan Canada as they attended the Maternal, Newborn, and Child Healthcare Summit in Toronto.
From saving lives to planning for the end of life. It's not often Tories, New Democrats, and Liberals vote in unison in the House of Commons, but they all agreed this week to back a motion calling on the government to establish a pan-Canadian palliative care strategy. The idea is to improve care at the end of life for people across the country. NDP MP Charlie Angus tabled the motion, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes caught up with him in the foyer of the House of Commons.
What prompted you to take on that issue?
It touches every Canadian. It touches every family. And it's something you just assume is there until you need it, and it's not there. I began to realize that there were major gaps across the country in terms of palliative and end-of-life care. You go into certain parts of the country, and there's really good programs in place. There's a coherent integrated strategy, and others you end up dealing with fragmented pieces, and when you deal with the fragments, families fall through the cracks, and it can be very traumatic, not just for the person who's suffering, but for the whole emotional and psychological dynamic of a family if those pieces are not in place.
Did you have an idea that there was sort of a common sense of the urgency of the issue in all parties in this before you tabled the motion?
I think what really made this motion succeed is that there's, out in the general community, outside the so-called Ottawa bubble, there is a real awareness of the need to address palliative and end-of-life issues. We had enormous support from the medical community from the beginning, from the frontline workers, the personal support workers, the nurses' associations, also individual Canadians, and the various faith communities for whom this is a very important issue. They did a lot of the heavy lifting of calling MPs' offices, of saying, put the partisanship aside, come together, and for once do something in Parliament that will actually send a message to Canadians that we do listen to what people out in the real world expect us to do with.
There is, a difference in opinion among MPs of different parties on how much of a lead role Ottawa should take in general on health care and social issues related to health care. What do you think the federal government's role should be? What would the policy response be?
I think when we were beginning to move the palliative care motion, I certainly was getting a sense that within the government this was something they were a little uncomfortable with because, frankly, the Stephen Harper government doesn't believe there's a federal role in health care. As New Democrats, we fundamentally disagree with that. The role that the federal government can play in terms of a national palliative care strategy is not to deliver the services. Certainly the provinces and the territories are much better equipped. It's not also to dictate, but to say we really need to look across the country. If Regina has a system that's really working and another city doesn't, how can we actually learn so that the provinces can deliver better health care? This isn't about throwing more money into the system. The money's already there. It's being spent. But where it's being spent in fragmented areas, we're not getting the results, even though probably we're spending more money with people ending up in eMERGE, people having to call ambulances in the middle of the night, the attempt to find bed for a dying loved one. That money is already being spent in the system. And then you look at where the systems are integrated, and it's actually costing the system a lot less money, and we're getting much better outcomes.
There's been some interest because of Stephen Fletcher's private members bill and the question of doctor-assisted suicide, people having a right to sort of end their lives when they want to. I know that's an extremely fraught issue. But when we've held town halls with the Canadian Medical Association on this at McLean's, we found that people actually link the two issues quite a lot, and that the sense that there isn't sufficient palliative care, hospice care, it gets tied up in people's sense of whether they want that power to end their lives. Do you see the two issues as being connected?
I was really impressed talking with the Canadian Medical Association, how clear they were that there was a need to deal with the issue of palliative care. I find it very troubling to expect politicians to wade into something as fraught as the issue of euthanasia and doctor-assisted suicide. I know within our caucus we had an excellent evening of discussion. We have medical doctors, nurses, legal minds, and we couldn't even agree on what the terms were. So these are really, really, really complicated issues when the common sense solution is staring us in the face. What the medical community is saying, what the people who deal with the sick and the dying are, is that let's deal with the 99% who need palliative care. The other issues of the 1%, those complex issues, those can be discussed. But you can't discuss that in a vacuum. And right now, with the lack of palliative support, we certainly have a vacuum in Canada.
This is starting to feel to me like one of these issues, like maybe like the way depression was at one point, or even gay marriage, where people start out uncomfortable talking about it. There's even a taboo book talking about it. And then surprisingly quickly, it seems to me at least, surprisingly quickly, people get over that. And as soon as some people start talking about polygamy, everybody feels more comfortable, you know, airing views, even on something this freighted with emotion and religious issues, personal morality issues.
What really struck me when I started this discussion is everyone has a story. Everyone has a good experience or a really traumatic experience. So I've been finding when we've been holding our public forums, as a politician, I'm used to the back and forth, but you end up seeing the incredible profundity that exists in average people who've wrestled with this, and they look to government and say, where are you? Do the right thing here. And so this may be a moment where we get this conversation, and it is a conversation. Maybe this conversation will help us take this issue further.
That's McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with NDP MP Charlie Angus about his motion calling for a Canada-wide strategy for palliative care. If you're looking for more on this topic, McLean's.ca has extensive coverage of end-of-life issues.
Coming up, what will the government do about its troubled fighter jet procurement, and what should we expect from new environmental laws from U.S. President Barack Obama?
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up, we take a look at new environmental laws about to be announced by U.S. President Barack Obama. But first,
among the toughest policy decisions hanging over the government this spring is what to do about the troubled F-35 fighter jet program. This week, Public Works Minister Dianne Finley told defense contractors the federal cabinet will finish reviewing the options on the multi-billion-dollar purchase within the next few weeks. For expert insights on the tough choices the government faces, Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sat down with David Perry, a senior analyst with the Conference of Defense Associations Institute.
David, thanks for being here with us. Let me just recap as briefly as possible a bit of the F-35 story for listeners who might not be sure about the details. It was back in the summer of 2010 that the government announced, or seemed to announce, its plan to buy 65 Lockheed Martin Joint Strike Fighters. After that, we had about a year and a half of controversy about the real costs, until finally, near the end of 2012, the government says it's hitting the reset button on that procurement, and it assigns a new process, a panel and some other experts, to look into reviewing the F-35 and the options. It sounds like they've got two options: stick with the F-35s, which by the official estimate would cost a little less than $50 billion, or launch an open competition to let other jet makers compete for the contract. So, David, first off, can you say something about the time frame here? How long does the government realistically have to make some decisions?
It all depends on kind of what they want to do in terms of the replacement schedule for the existing fighter fleet. Now, a lot of the work that was driven to date was based on the assumption that they had to make a decision relatively soon because they needed to start replacing the CF-18 starting around sort of 2017. So they're basically at a point in their life frame where the government's going to have to face a choice, either to replace them or, if it's been determined is possible, to spend some extra money to make some upgrades to keep them flying a little bit longer. Mm. But I think basically they're looking at to continue the option of proceeding to buy F-35 if that's a desire. They'd have to make a decision relatively soon to start buying that particular aircraft along the same kind of timeline that had been laid out.
David, could I back you up just briefly to that question about whether or not they might opt to extend the life of the CF-18s? The skeptic and cynic and jaded political watcher in me says that could push things out past a 2015 election then, in terms of the hard decision. Is that correct?
I think that that's probably certainly an option. It doesn't mean that it necessarily be preferred by any chance. But for instance, our Sea King fleet was supposed to be replaced in the early to mid-90s.
Yeah.
And for a whole bunch of different reasons, that procurement has dragged on for roughly two decades beyond the date when they optimally wanted to replace them. Doesn't mean that that's an option that you necessarily would prefer to do, and it would mean that increasingly those aircraft, in terms of their operational capabilities, will become less and less relevant. But in terms of whether or not you can keep something flying safely and providing some kind of air support role, I think it's probably realistic that the government, if they wanted to spend the money, could keep them operating longer, if that's sort of viewed to be providing with a wider range of options, including that if you add another couple of years, the F-35 program would be more advanced. So you're potentially getting a better sense about really what that's offering if you just wait a couple of years.
David, on the what I guess is a fundamental part of the decision, which is the simple question of what is the best jet for the Canadian Forces? You know people in the defense world well. How do they see that choice being made? I assume it's not as clear-cut as saying, well, obviously this jet is better than that jet. What are the factors that will go into that decision?
I think really it kind of fundamentally comes down to how much capability you're getting in the aircraft relative to the dollars that you're going to spend,
right,
and whether or not there's a difference between the two. So I think we kind of got simplified to a certain extent in the discussion about a fifth generation aircraft is that clearly this is one that's on the leading edge of technology.
This is the F-35, the joint strike fighter.
Right.
That's on the leading edge for
it's
sure.
No debating
that.
Right. It's leading on the edge. Yeah, the fact that it's leading edge is part of the problem where it's been having challenges as it gets developed, because they're still implementing the technology, working out the bugs in this as they're actually starting to build aircraft.
Right.
Whereas you have all the other options are existing aircraft that have been flying for some period of time. They're much further along in their developmental cycle, so they're lower risk in terms of the availability of the aircraft, how much the costs associated with buying them are going to potentially change. But at the same time, it means that they are really older technology that provides you with ability to respond to older threats and older operating scenarios. F-35, I think, is pretty clearly a lot further advanced. So I think what fundamentally the choice is going to kind of come down to here is, if it is the case that the F-35 would be significantly more costly than one of the other options, and if one of those other options would provide a reasonable level of aircraft for the government, whether or not they'd choose to pay a premium if it exists to keep with the F-35, or whether or not they opt to take whatever savings they could realize by choosing one of the other four, and going in a different route and accepting that you're not going to have that same level of capability.
Just briefly, can you tell me a couple of the other options? There's the Hornet. There's what else is out there?
Hornet, the French Rafale, and the Eurofighter Typhoon were the three that were the extensively reviewed as part of the options analysis.
What do you make of this debate over industrial benefits, the economic spinoffs? That's something the government is now highlighting in their new defense procurement strategy. How do you think that argument plays out?
I think this is actually one of the probably one of the toughest examples to look at the different kind of options that would be available. Mm. What the government's doing as part of the new procurement strategy is trying to get better, more meaningful economic leverage from defense purchases. So in the past, for the most part, we've had the industrial regional benefits policy, which basically worked out arrangements to provide an equivalent amount of offset relative to the procurement cost.
So what you're spending gets spent in your economy, kind of. Is that roughly
exactly
how it works?
It gets spent somehow in the economy. What they're proposing to do under this new system is actually not just have an equivalent amount of spending, but actually have that spending targeted in more meaningful ways that would lead to long-term commercial viability, export opportunities. And to do that, they're trying to incentivize ways to get innovation and technology transfer included as part of the bids.
Mm.
So what's interesting, I think, is that the F-35 was actually a different type of arrangement altogether. So it wasn't set up so that you would have that same kind of one-for-one IRB commitment. The way the program was set up, that if you participated early, as Canada did, then your corporate entities would be able to put in bids and potentially win work on the program. But the catch in all that is that to keep that participation, you actually have to decide at some point to buy the plane. So it'd just be a different type of economic benefit. And I think one of the real challenges for the government is going to be trying to try and evaluate between some pretty potentially very different options,
yeah,
which of those really is more benefit to Canada.
Not just evaluate them, but ultimately explain them, right? This is a complicated set of conditions, and the public has already engaged in this because it's become so, you know, such a hot-button issue that now the government's put itself in a position where whatever decision it makes is going to have to somehow be communicated. And, I mean, you know how complex this stuff is. I don't know if they've ever had to explain in detail this kind of a defense procurement arrangement, you know, sell it politically. It's almost unique, isn't it?
It's absolutely going to be, I think, very difficult to communicate whatever option they choose, because I don't think there's any real clear-cut choices where some options are 100% obvious.
Slam
and
dunk,
the other ones,
you say. That's
yeah, there's
what
no
you
slam
do.
Dunks, I don't think. I think there's merits to any of the different approaches that they choose.
David, thanks for explaining all this to us. A really fascinating file.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
That was Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes in conversation with defense analyst David Perry.
On Monday, the Obama administration in the U.S. is expected to announce its biggest climate change policy yet, a new rule clamping down on greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel-fired power plants, which are the largest contributors to carbon pollution in the U.S. Canada already has a strict rule on coal-fired plants, but they represent a much smaller part of our energy mix. Canada has yet to act on the biggest source of emissions, the oil and gas sector. For a preview of Obama's announcement, McLean's Washington Bureau Chief Louisa Savage speaks with Kyle Ahrens, a senior fellow at the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions.
Kyle, so in the big picture, how important is this rule to getting the U.S. On a trajectory to reducing its climate emissions?
This rule is extremely important. The Obama administration has already dealt with the transportation sector through fuel economy standards, and now we're addressing the power sector, which is the largest single source of carbon dioxide emissions in the United States. In fact, it's responsible for nearly 40% of our carbon dioxide emissions. So there are a lot of opportunities for reductions here, and it's pretty critical that we bring those emissions down if we want to curb the risks of climate change.
Now, the timing of this is interesting because the midterm elections are coming up, and there's been a lot of backlash already before the rule's even been announced from Republicans and some coal state Democrats saying that the president is waging a, quote, war on coal. You know, some of the most vulnerable Democrats are running for re-election in these conservative states and states that are opposed to this rule. So why now? Why is the president in a rush to do this right now, several months ahead of November, when he could just wait to December or January to do this?
Right now, we're just going to see a proposed rule from EPA, and we could see a lot of changes in that rule between now and a year from now when the rule is finalized. So while a proposed rule could be difficult politically for some Democrats, as you mentioned, in coal states, it would probably be even worse if they have a final rule to deal with, because then Congress can take more formal action through the Congressional Review Act against the EPA's rule. So Obama has a balance to deal with here in, you know, on one hand, he might want to avoid midterm elections, but on the other hand, he wants this rule to be well along its path while he's still in office. So as it stands now, states will be submitting their proposed plans to EPA probably during the summer and fall of 2016. And, of course, Obama will be leaving office at the beginning of 2017. So if he were to delay much, that pushes the whole time frame back, and we might not get much action at all while Obama's still in office.
Do you get the sense that he wants this to be a part of his legacy? The Congress failed to pass climate change legislation, cap and trade, and now he's working through the EPA sort of unilaterally through an executive agency. Do you get the sense that this is something he wants to accomplish at the top of his agenda before he leaves office?
Yeah. First, I'd like to mention it's not really working unilaterally, since EPA is drawing from its authority through the Clean Air Act. So it's using existing legislation. Of course, we would prefer climate change to be addressed through comprehensive legislation, since that way you can deal with all the sectors at once in a more consistent manner. But we think this is a good approach, since we won't see that. And then in terms of Obama's personal legacy, he has announced that he's going to be personally announcing these rules on Monday, June 2nd. So that strongly suggests to us that he has a personal stake in this, and he's made climate change a more important part of his agenda. We saw that last summer with the release of his climate action plan. So yes, I think that's definitely a legacy issue for him.
And once the EPA comes out with a final rule, is that a done deal? What kind of obstacles might still be out there?
Yeah, so there are both political and legal obstacles. So once the final rule is issued, Congress, using something called the Congressional Review Act, has a set amount of time to review the rule, and it can pass a law that could essentially repeal EPA's rule. And it's the Congressional Review Act kind of allows that process to be fast-tracked. But that would require votes in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and it would have to be signed off by the President. So while we can, with the House controlled by Republicans, it will almost certainly pass the House, but the Senate and the President are another story. So that's the political side. And then on the legal side, we will definitely see legal challenges to this rule from probably from both states and power companies stating that EPA has exceeded its Clean Air Act authority or has somehow not followed the Clean Air Act correctly when crafting this rule. And so it's tough to predict what those arguments will be until we see the actual proposal from EPA, but we can safely bet that there will be challenges in the courts.
That's McLean's Washington Bureau Chief Louisa Savage speaking with Kyle Ahrens, a senior fellow at the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions.
And now it's time for our question period in review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on McLean's.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
What a slog MPs are in for. They voted this week to sit until midnight until the House of Commons rises for the summer. Over the next few weeks, they'll spend a lot of time staring, mouthing off, laughing, and generally scowling at each other. Things got a little silly already during question period this week. On Monday, the last question of the day came from Brent Rathgaber, the independent MP from Edmonton who used to be a Conservative. He asked Employment Minister Jason Kenney about a theory that temporary foreign workers may be paid more than their Canadian counterparts. Here's how Kenney reacted.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've heard some bizarre things in this debate, but that takes the cake. Couldn't be further from the truth, Mr. Speaker.
On Tuesday, NDP MP Nathan Cullen tried to embarrass Tory MP Scott Reed, who sits on the board at discount retailer Giant Tiger. That company's CEO recently encouraged the government to abandon its latest trademark reform, but Cullen stumbled on the question, and afterwards, Reed made him pay.
During question period, the New Democratic House leader raised a question in which I think he was making reference to me. He referred to me as the member from Lanark Carlton, and he indicated that I am on the board of directors of a company called Giant Target. I just want to inform him that I was the member for Lanark Carlton before that riding ceased to exist a decade ago, about the same time he arrived here, and that I am not on the board of directors of Giant Target, but of Giant Tiger. Rumors of our merger with Target are overstated. But on the positive side, I believe if he wants to take out a trademark of the name Giant Target, it's available.
On Wednesday, Liberal MP John McCallum went after Immigration Minister Chris Alexander's handling of a blacklist meant to punish abusive employers. An exasperated McCallum got pretty personal.
He's addicted to this silly conservative line about cleaning up a liberal mess, which did not exist in those days. If we want to be more serious, this guy talks about employers on the list. There are zero employers on any list for abuse of employees. So I would ask this minister, or if he doesn't know, I'll ask the real minister, can he name one employer on either list on the list for abusing employee rights? Can either of the ministers answer that question?
Speaker Andrew Scheer had finally had enough. He lashed out, uncharacteristically for him, at anyone who was slowing things down in the chamber.
Order. There are some members whose name appear later down on my list, but I'm worried that they're going to run out of breath by then. I'll ask them to come to order, lest that they be too tired to be recognized by the speaker later on. The honorable member for Markham Unionville.
Let's hope Scheer finds a way to relax, perhaps at the lunchtime yoga sessions on Parliament's front lawn every Wednesday. It's worth a shot. Otherwise, he could be in for a few long weeks and, well, maybe even an ulcer or two.
Once again, with Question Period and Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.